Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a Super Bloom podcast. Hello, it's me. Hi, it's Candace King. I'm very honored and excited and thrilled and all the things to be sitting down with today's guest. She is a journalist. I read an article of hers in the New York Times a couple weeks back. She had interviewed three 13-year-old girls about what it's like to be 13 in America these days with social media and just things that I didn't experience. I am a millennial. I know that we make fun of that word a lot, kind of. And by we, I mean the youth. The youth, I know that there's a lot of things on the tickety-talk and the Instagram about like what millennials say. And then I read them and then I watch them to be like, oh, this isn't going to be true. And then it is like spot on. Like, yeah, I do walk around the grocery store and love the soundtrack, okay? They're playing some bops. They're playing some bops in the bread aisle, all right? So sue me. But I read this article and it's just, you know, I know that I've talked about my family and that I have had the great honor and opportunity to be a part of watching my stepdaughters, you know, as they grew up throughout their teenage years, and they're now 18 and 21. But even watching them, I would be like reminded and revisit, you know, my own experiences as a teenager and how vastly different it felt watching them go through their experiences. And even though the experiences themselves could be the exact same, you know, where it's like you're in middle school or it's like friend drama or like a, you know, romantic drama, like things that are kind of that you're going to see in any generation you're going to experience, you know, but it felt different because of social media. It just felt wildly different trying to picture their experiences. So I read this article by journalist Jessica Bennett, and it really left an impact on me. Continued to read many of her articles and listen to her new podcast. And I was like, I got to sit down with Jessica. We got some stuff to talk about. She has had an award-winning journalism career, focusing a gender lens on social issues and culture, from the persistence of workplace inequality to the ripple effects of Me Too. Jessica was the first ever gender editor of the New York Times and is the author of two best-selling books, Feminist Fight Club, A Survival Manual for a Sexist Workplace, and This is 18, Girls' Lives Through Girls' Eyes. Jessica is also an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University, where she teaches a course called Reporting the Zeitgeist. She's profiled figures as varied as E. Jean Carroll and Pamela Anderson, and written features on call-out culture, the changing nature of sexual consent on college campuses, and chronicled the battle for a more inclusive Miss America. Jessica is also a co-host of a new podcast called In Retrospect, which looks back at cultural moments from the past and see if they look different in retrospect. Whether it's a scandalous tabloid story seared into our teenage brains or political punchlines that just feels wrong now. In Retrospect looks back at cultural moments from the past and sees if they look different in retrospect to try to understand what they taught us about the world and a woman's place in it. You can follow Jessica at Jessica Bennett on Instagram, as well as her podcast at In Retro Pod. Without further ado, here is my interview with journalist Jessica Bennett. Congratulations, by the way, on your new podcast.
Thank you. In retrospect,
it's fantastic. And it's funny, even just like talking for, you know, about the article that you wrote about the, you know, you interviewed three different 13-year-old girls over the course of a year to kind of feel like what it's like to be a 13, you know, a 13-year-old girl right now. And you said, yeah, I just remember that time so vividly. And I have been like trying to remember so many things of my youth because I feel like now in my 30s, it's like I'm trying to make sense of my behavioral patterns or the way that I think and the way that I do things. And not because I'm discovering them about myself for the first time, but because I'm truly seeing the pattern and the repetition of them and knowing that so much of that comes from the things that we've seen or experienced in our youth. It's just an interesting time to be so reflective. Were you inspired to write that article yourself? Did someone kind of bring this idea to you? Because 13 is just such a very particular age in a woman's life.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember my 13-year-old year so vividly in like a way that is weird. I'm now in my 40s, but I think I most identify with that teenage self in some way. It's like where so much of my personality and who I was becoming and my identity was formed. And I think a lot of my independence too. But the reason I started out wanting to document these girls at that age was in part because I was thinking about how different it is for 13-year-olds today, because that's the age at which they're allowed to join social media. And so all of the things that I went through and probably you went through too, at least they could shut off at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Or if you were having a drama with a friend, you would go home or maybe you would work it out. But you'd be like, if you were me, you'd be isolated in your room with the door shut playing like really loud Nirvana. But you wouldn't be checking social media to see what people are saying about you all the time. And I happen to know also that girls' self-confidence and self-esteem, and I think this was really true of me as well, tends to dip right around that age. Like as soon as girls hit the middle school years, their self-esteem tends to plummet 3 times the rate of boys. And so girls today are in this really precarious time where at the same moment that they're starting to struggle, starting to revert inward, you know, raising their hands less in class, not speaking up as much, they're able to join the social media sites. And so I was really interested in what the intersection of those things looked like.
It's interesting. I read or I was listening to an interview with Aubrey Plaza a while back, and she was talking about how she'd gone to an all-girls school. And it wasn't until later on that she was in, you know, mixed-gendered company in a classroom setting where she was just so confused because she kept raising her hand. And she was like, I didn't know, like, other people weren't raising their hand, like,
other girls weren't
raising their hands. And you don't think about those things affecting you in the long run. But I've even had to really realize that in my adulthood. And even though, like, I consider myself to be a very independent person. I lived alone a lot, even throughout my 20s and early 20s. And I, you know, felt very capable. I was like, well, I'm like an independent feminist. I go to the movies by myself. Like I can sit and read a book at a table all by myself at a restaurant because I am secure with who I am. And yet parallel to that, I find myself so often in business settings or like having a, you know, current events conversation and that I just want to be like quiet. And I'm like, well, I don't know better. They probably know the answer more than I do. And generally I direct that that towards other men in the room. And it's taken me a really long time to kind of figure out like why I minimize my voice and just decide that like they must know better. And I think back, like, you know, even in regards to your podcast, looking at things that were so prevalent in pop culture around times when, you know, that I was in my young adulthood. And so much of that was around like this bizarre kind of like intersection of like, you know, girl power, Spice Girls, feminism, yes, yes, yes. But then also, here's how you get a man, here's how you keep a man. And like, you have to look the part, play the part, but also like, pretend that you're doing everything yourself. And it's just been very confusing ever since. Like, have you found that going back and trying to figure out pop culture things that really stood out to you that made you kind of look back at your adolescence in a different way?
Like you were saying, you start to notice that you have these patterns and these behaviors in your adult life. And you're like, where did I learn those messages? Where did that come from? And so part of the idea with this podcast was, there's so much stuff that we internalized growing up as teenagers in the, for me, the late 80s and 90s, what we consumed on television, the movies we were watching, like the games we played at school, the language, the way people talked about sex and consent, but like consent wasn't a word back then, and sexuality and bodies and all of these things. And I think we really internalized them to a large degree. Like, I feel like a lot of my millennial friends now, that there's this whole conversation happening around Ozempic and thinness and weight, have been discussing how, as someone raised in that era, it was like impossible to come out of that without hating your body, no matter what you looked like. Mm-hmm. Like, we just couldn't do body positivity because we grew up on magazines that were telling us the opposite, and not just magazines, but all sorts of different kinds of media. So part of what we wanted to do in this podcast, I co-host it with a good friend of mine, Susie Banacaram. She's a journalist as well, but was to look back at these moments, whether they're pop culture moments or political moments, or even like the smell of Axe body spray, which I don't know if that emanated through the halls of your high school, but it certainly emanated through mine, to try to get at what those things taught us. And sometimes they're really subtle and sometimes they're insidious and they're not necessarily overt. And it's not that I want to look back on these things and say like, oh my God, those were all so problematic. Like, can you believe that we consumed this stuff? It's more like, what did we learn from them and how has that played out in our adult lives?
What was the word feminism to you in young adulthood? Because obviously like gender has been a very big part of your career also in the last decade, as far as, you know, that you were, but what did the word feminism, well, let's start there. What did feminism mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, that was not a word that I grew up using. I grew up in Seattle. I have really progressive parents. I have younger brothers. And it was sort of just assumed in my upbringing that, like, of course I could accomplish whatever my brothers could and more. And it was almost like so assumed that we didn't need to use that word or talk about it. And so I've written about this, but it really wasn't until I got my first real job and I had moved to New York and I was becoming a journalist in a corporate environment that I sort of found myself looking around being like, wait, all these guys are getting ahead more quickly than I am. And how come when they speak, people listen? And when I speak, people don't? Or why is it the idea I just pitched for a story was sort of shot down and now I see that it has appeared in the magazine under a guy's byline? So it was all of these subtle things where I was like, okay, but wait, like, haven't we achieved equality? Like, what could this be? This must be me. Like, the problem must be me. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, for me, a journey in my early 20s of being like, okay, this is systemic. This is a political problem. I mean, like the age-old saying, it's political, not personal, or the personal is political. It was a journey of learning that it wasn't just me. These were systemic things. There was still systemic inequity in the very place that I was working, even in this was the 2010s. And, you know, it may not have been as overt as it once was. It may not have been anything that you could even document in any real way, but it was there. And that was when I re-embraced the word feminism.
Well, that's also, I mean, the other trope is like, oh, well, I'm sure you were off on your own because all girls are competitive and you wouldn't have anyone else to talk to in the workplace who would like have your back because it's all just catfights everywhere. But were you having open conversations with other women in the workplace about what you were experiencing? Did that also help shift the like, oh, this isn't a me problem. This is maybe more of a systemic issue within the corporate workplace as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that I could have come to that on my own. But I had a pretty unique experience in that my first real job out of college was at Newsweek magazine. And this was a place that I had grown up reading the magazine. You know, back then it was one of the two big magazines, Newsweek and Time, that were still in print. Like, it was kind of the dream job. And so when I got there and wasn't excelling as fast as I thought maybe I should have, it was really confusing. And it was only talking to other young women about their frustrations as well that I started to realize, and that we started to realize collectively, like, oh, okay, this is a bigger thing. And then what ended up happening was, so a couple of female colleagues and I, they were both young, they were around my same age, we were out of college a couple of years, we were pretty early on in our careers, and kind of struggling, trying to rise up. We learned and discovered that Newsweek, where we worked, was actually the place where in the year 1970, 46 women had sued the magazine for gender discrimination in what was the first lawsuit of its kind. And that lawsuit was groundbreaking and huge, and it paved the way for women journalists. So literally the reason we were there and able to be journalists at all, even if we felt like we weren't getting ahead, was because of these women who had come 40 years before us. And yet nobody had told us that story. And so this is like before you could Google this, which you can now because there's been more recent writing about it. So I will never forget being with these two women who were my friends and like racing back to one of our computers and searching like Newsweek women lawsuit, like what happened to this, and finding absolutely nothing. And then us having to go down to the New York Public Library and look through the microfiche and find the old stories about this actual lawsuit. And so that for me was a real turning point in understanding that we were part of a larger system. And in our case, we were part of this really historic place where in some ways the history had been lost to time.
Was that part of an inciting incident that would become Feminist Fight Club later on for you, or?
Yes. So there's a lot of these kind of circles or second degrees of separation throughout the course of my career. But yeah, what happened was, you know, like journalists do, we started reporting that story and we were determined to write about what happened with these women 40 years prior who had sued the magazine for gender discrimination in 2012, I think it was, when we were first discovering this. And through that process, we tracked down the original women from that lawsuit, one of whom had a daughter who was in this women's group that she introduced me to. And that was the Feminist Fight Club that I would then join and would become the subject of my book. And that it was essentially a group of women who were in different industries in media and production and television and comedy who were meeting monthly to talk about their careers and helping one another. And so it was through this woman who had sued Newsweek, who would go on to become the first woman senior editor at Newsweek, who introduced me to her daughter, who introduced me to the Fight Club, which then became the subject of my book. And then ultimately that same editor would go on to write a book about that Newsweek lawsuit called The Good Girls Revolt. And if that sounds familiar, maybe to Hollywood, to you as a Hollywood person or people who consume television, that's because it got made into a television series on Amazon that was very good, but then got canceled, sadly.
Sadly, it was very good.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's interesting because, I mean, this is from even just looking at the decade of like 2010 to 2020 and also just reading about your career and looking at your career and that kind of that's where it started and where it's like you're also going to get into the Me Too movement and then also but then the 2016 president election and the really big, you know, gender. I don't even have the words for it because it just makes me like my stomach flip all over again and brings me back to being in New York on that very, what was a sad day for me, holding my daughter.
Election day?
Mm-hmm. Yes. To go through all of these experiences where finally things are coming out and that there's hope, but then also, you know, the Trump presidential years and the, you know, his comments on women specifically, and then working at the, you know, as someone who specifically was writing for gender at the New York Times. I'm sorry, I have my notes on my phone because I've been moving and I can't find my printer still.
No worries.
But
like, that's all accurate.
I cannot believe, like, I can't imagine wrapping your head around so many things that feel like you're moving forward while also so many archaic conversations that feels like, are we still talking like this about women? Is there, what, did you have days like that where you're like, how am I having both of these conversations at the same time in the same day? Like, what were your experiences being a journalist at that point?
Well, so what ended up happening, so after, you know, I made this discovery at Newsweek and I would go on to write this book, and I'd been writing for the New York Times for a number of years, but as a freelancer. And ultimately, I got this job as the first ever gender editor. And the job began right after the Women's March, right after the election. You know, obviously, so many people, including myself, really thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win and were absolutely stunned and heartbroken when she didn't. And then when I took this job, it was a couple of months before my colleagues, Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey, would write the story that would spark the Me Too movement about Harvey Weinstein. And so suddenly I'm in this new role. You know, there's never been a job like this before. We're still kind of figuring out like what exactly it is. And there's a lot of internal, you know, complexity and politics around how you function in this giant news organization that's never had a role like this before. And then Me Too erupted. The hashtag was retweeted by Alyssa Milano. You probably remember this story. Mm-hmm. It was originally created by Tarana Burke. Mm-hmm. Story after story after story started pouring out about executives in Hollywood and then about factory workers. And then almost every single industry, it was like you could go down the boxes just checking them off. Men were being fired and exposed for horrible, horrible behavior. So it was a wild time to be in a newsroom trying to manage coverage, but also trying to keep up with it. And there wasn't really a precedent for how you reported a lot of this stuff. I think in many ways, that original story about Harvey Weinstein by Megan and Jody created the precedent for how you report these types of stories. But, you know, things like corroborations and following the paper trail and making sure you had documentation for everything so that people couldn't dismiss what you were finding as he said, she said, or as, you know, some sort of polemic or an opinion piece. And so there were moments when our inbox was just flooded with women sharing their own stories of abuse and assault. And it was absolutely more than you could possibly respond to, more than one person could reply to. And I remember at one point having to create some sort of auto reply that would go to people who were emailing this general inbox that could try to account for, please know that we're reading your stories, but we just can't reply to everyone. And thinking like, this is the most crass thing I've ever had to write. Like, how do you minimize someone's story by giving an auto message? Yeah. But there were moments like that where, you know, you knew that something really important was happening and you knew that your colleagues were, you know, changing the world in many ways by reporting on this. And yet there were so many stories that you couldn't possibly give them all attention.
I just remember that time so vividly, like getting together with, you know, female friends of mine and sitting around and just, and while the subject matter was so heavy, everyone came and everyone just began sharing at a level of vulnerability, which, you know, typically women are emotional creatures. I'm a very emotional person and female. I surround myself with generally emotional women as well, who and emotional in the sense that they're emotionally vulnerable. Like we share a lot of things with each other. So I'd had a lot of deep personal conversations with my friends, but these in particular just felt like there was a weight lifted off that like everyone's like heart and soul and shoulders that they'd just been carrying for so long, and being able to, you know, which goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, re-examine moments within their lives and really be able to not follow a narrative that's been taught to them by how like society wants you to think that it was, you know, like, oh, well, then I probably shouldn't have been wearing that skirt if I didn't want someone to walk up behind me at a bar and put their hand underneath my skirt and grab me. Like, that's just what guys do at bars. Like, I remember telling myself that. I remember thinking like, that's just what happens. And in that time period being like, why did I just think that that was something that happens? So I can't imagine reading and wanting to honor all the stories that you were getting and report that, you know, and your job as a journalist at that time and also trying to like process it yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was part of what was so interesting is that all of the women covering this had experienced it in one form or another, you know? So yeah, in the day you're at your job and you're reporting on the subject and then you get home and you're like talking to your girlfriends or your partner or whoever it might be about like, yeah, this made me think of this thing that happened. And did X thing ever happen to you? And I wonder if my mom has a story like this. And oh, actually, my grandmother once told me something about this. It just like the floodgates opened. And I think it was really important because it took the secrecy out of it. And people were talking openly. But once they were talking openly, you saw just how widespread it was.
At what point, I think, like, I feel like also there is this really, it's been interesting because it felt like this, like, renaissance. It felt like this very, like, powerful thing. And then now it's also, like, we can get into that whole discussion, which I know you guys kind of do on your podcast a little bit as well. But, like, there's this, you obviously ended up sitting down with Monica Lewinsky. And this was within a couple years of, as Me Too was beginning and really in the thick of it. And you know, your interview with her really gave a narrative, allowed her to take her narrative back of like what she experienced. And I think that allowed the world to re-examine the way that it participated in this very unbalanced power dynamic and see it now through a much clearer perspective. Did you know when you were sitting down with Monica what that interview was going to be like? Did she approach you? Did you approach her? How did that come about?
Yeah, I approached her. This was actually a few years before me too. And I've profiled Monica.
I'm so sorry. Well,
it's not you. I've profiled her twice.
Okay.
So the first time was before, and then the second time was after, which was kind of an interesting, I've never done that before. So it was really interesting to see how she had grown. But the first time I was writing a column for Time magazine, and I wrote this column about how we owe Monica Lewinsky an apology, like a collective apology, because of the way she was treated in the 90s. And I really wanted to speak with her, and I had heard that she was getting ready to potentially do a TED talk about cyberbullying. And then at a certain point, she wrote an essay for Vanity Fair about her experience. And I reached out to her. A friend of mine had her email from something way in the past, and I reached out to her and I wrote this very long email making the case for why I thought it was so important that, you know, even though she hadn't spoken publicly, and I think it was a decade at that point, that I would love to document her process of getting ready to give this big talk and tell her story through the lens of now, because I had grown up on that story. Like, I remember being in high school and getting the copy of Newsweek magazine about the Starr report and like all of the gory details about Bill Clinton and the cigar and like all of it, and us sitting around our lockers being like, oh my God, this is so scandalous. And also like, who is this woman? And she showed her thong to the president. Like, what is that about? And I think the underlying narrative there was like, who is this slut? Mm-hmm. And so then years later, to start looking back at the coverage that I consumed at the time as a teenager and being like, oh my God, this is awful. Like, how, you can't talk about women like this anymore. And she was basically a child. She had no power in the situation. He's the president of the United States. Like, the power dynamic is so slanted. And then the way she was absolutely scorned in the press, you know, they called her like a little tart. There were all of these polls that different news outlets put out that were basically like, do you think Monica Lewinsky is a slut? Yes or no? Like, things that just would never happen today. And she really, really suffered as a result of that. So I didn't know if she would be open to it. I didn't know how long it would take. It ended up being a long time. And it wasn't just one sit down. It was over the course of many months getting to know her, trying to get her to trust me. You know, she had every reason not to trust a journalist. And so it was a challenging assignment and story, but I think ultimately what it did was it was able to look at this woman's life through the lens of the current time. And for the people reading it then to think like, wow, it wasn't that long ago, but the way that we talked about her and the way that she was portrayed was really crazy.
Yeah.
And then it was really nice to be able to come back and sit down with her again. I think it was 7 years later to be like, okay, so now what? Like, now you've built this whole new career around cyberbullying and kindness, and you're writing regularly for Vanity Fair, and your TED Talk was wildly successful, and now you're a producer on this show that is looking back at your life. And what is that like?
And that, yeah, that's what I had read that one recently. And just to see that, because we're also seeing that so wonderfully. Like, I loved Pamela Anderson, like, taking kind of her narrative, like, taking, like, her story back, who I know that you also sat down with, and even, you know, just, it's, and then I think that there's other, like, versions of that we're starting to see, where we look back and see the way that that Britney Spears was, like, portrayed in the press then, and then also how she's still continued to be portrayed in the press now, and we don't all just want to, like, we all just want to decide that we know what is going on in her life and like have all the answers, which we don't. But it's just, and that's where it's this interesting kind of new path, I think, for the ability for people wanting to like kind of re-narrate someone's life or allow them to re-narrate themselves. But we're also in this wild time where like everyone's got an opinion, everyone's on social media, and everyone's like cutting things together and making their own narratives of other people's narratives. How have you seen that going? Like in when you start to see people like what, like Britney Spears being a perfect example, like paralleling that to like even a Pamela Anderson, you know, it's like, it's on one hand, it's been so like wonderful that finally people like, you know, are allowing others to take accountability for putting these like women at very young ages. Like these were young women in these awful positions of like talking about their bodies and like their sexuality in such a predatory way and tearing them apart for it. And then in the now, the juxtaposition of like trying to control, like put them on a different kind of pedestal, I guess, just.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's weird and it's complicated. And as much as I'm like, oh, it's so great that we're revisiting so many of these women's stories, I can't help but also be slightly cynical about it in some ways. Like, you know, so Pamela Anderson, for instance, she now has put out a memoir that she wrote entirely herself. She was a producer on a documentary about her life that her son was largely in charge of. So she had a lot of control there. But this was all coming after that Hulu series, Pam and Tommy, which I watched and was like good and funny and interesting and was based on her life, but did not involve her. And she was staunchly opposed to it existing. And in her mind, it was like, look, that sex tape was the most humiliating thing of my life. And now these outside people are going to take it and exploit it yet again, but like in the name of empowerment in some way, and they're going to make money off it. And I'm not making money off of it. And shouldn't I be involved in this project if it's going to exist? So I do think it's sort of like, and I think I'm part of this too. It's like, there is a whole cottage industry now almost around looking back and revisiting things that look differently in the present day. And so how do you do that responsibly without just either, you know, trashing everyone who might have enjoyed a thing in the past and being like, oh, well, you're problematic and dismissing them, or without retelling the story in a way that, like, you don't actually know about. Like, we don't actually know what Britney Spears is going through. She has a memoir that's going to come out soon. Hopefully we will find out there. But everyone, as you said, on the internet seems to think that they have an opinion and know what's best and that it's worthy of being heard. And so there's just a lot more noise out there and a lot more kind of smug, you know, categorizing of people, I think.
Yeah. What is your opinion on cancel culture as it is right now? I think it's had like an evolution as well, that I think as social media is evolving, I think also as like people who start, I mean, the generation below, two generations below us, we grew up with the internet, but a very slow dial plug-in internet. It is not what it is today. Whereas like there will one day be a president that had like a full Instagram of, you know, documenting every single moment. There will one day be people in government who probably their sonogram photo is out on the internet, because that is how like our society has like kind of moved along culturally and pop culture of like share, document. You know, what has your, as a reporter and a journalist, like what is your take? And even if there's a different word for cancel culture, but basically, you know, making space for the fact that people are living their lives out online at this point.
I mean, look, so X, formerly known as Twitter, is a hellhole and is maybe dying and going away. And I think that's actually going to help a lot if you're a person who doesn't believe that people should just be entirely written off for like a 140-character tweet. I guess my feeling is like, I believe in being careful with your words, but I also believe in grace and mistakes and learning from your mistakes. And I don't think that a lot of the absolutist culture that we've been living in over the past few years has allowed for that. I did a story a couple of years ago about a woman. She's a professor at Smith College, and she teaches a class called Calling In,
not calling out. And it's all devoted to how students of social justice and of movements can have like healthy face-to-face conversations that may be difficult, but don't involve just like dragging the person online. And she really believes in this idea of like allowing for grace, and that just because something is a difficult conversation to have doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It doesn't mean that someone is committing verbal violence against you. Like, there's a lot of this inflation of rhetoric and inflation of language when it comes to talking about sensitive subjects. And I guess my feeling is just like, sure, there are people that are saying terrible things out there, but there are also a lot of people that might mess it up one time or two and want to get it right and can learn from it and move on. So like, it's complicated. It's like, accountability is a good thing ultimately. And maybe we're living in an age that has none of it if you look to who our president recently was. And so maybe there's a feeling that when you can't control some of the larger issues, people feel power by being able to draw people down online.
What's your relationship been with journalism? With, for you, your personal relationship being a writer, being a journalist, has that evolved and changed over the last decade? Because everything is online, everything's immediate, in like, the, you know, you need the headline, you need the clickbait, you need that. Like, I often wonder like what that must be like, knowing that you need to be correct and efficient and do all your homework and research, but then also it.
Well, I guess one thing that's different is that if you screw something up, you'll be notified immediately.
Yes.
By people on the internet. You know, like the fact checking process happens much more quickly. There's a guy on Twitter who is called, I think it's called NYT Typos. And hey, all he does is point out typos and grammatical errors in the New York Times all day long. And so like within minutes, I mean, it's really incredible. Like, he actually should be hired as a copy editor because he's so fast. But within moments of any story coming out, he has schooled you on everything you got wrong about it. So you're very much aware of what you might have screwed up. But, you know, I began my career at this weird time where, like, all the mainstream institutions knew that they had to get online or they were going to die. And they were looking to people like us, these millennials, to, like, help explain it to them, while at the same time sort of being like, well, nobody cares about, like, Newsweek.com. So, like, okay, little girl who just graduated college, you go work on the website and we serious people will be working on the print magazine. But it ended up being great for me because I learned everything about the web. And so for me, it's like I've always been thinking about how I frame stories and what the most effective medium for my stories is, and that it may not always be the written word. And I think that actually now working in media, places have caught up. So it's actually nice in a sense. But yeah, certainly it's different. I mean, everything moves so quickly and you're having to think about delivering your story in like six formats, not just one.
Man, oh yeah, because there's the audio element as well. And
it's like everything.
Everything.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, at least what I've been very encouraged by are so many articles and write-ups coming out lately that it has been, speaking of feminism, just like a kick-ass summer for the ladies, like that we have just been just crushing it when it comes to the U.S. economy and all things to, you know, Queen Beyoncé, Taylor Swift and Greta Gerwig. It is like, has that been enjoyable to see on your end as someone who's written so much about women and gender and feminism?
Yeah, I mean, look, like, I think that I've gotten slightly cynical of when these things happen and everyone's like, rah, rah, the women are taking over in the midst of, like, actual constitutional rights being taken away.
Yes, yes. As someone who lives in Tennessee, yes, I feel that deeply.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, like, yeah, did I go see Barbie? Was it so fun? And did I love it? Yes, for sure. And I think in a lot of ways, it managed to be really subversive while doing the pop thing. But by the same token, I'm always wary of like, well, if people seem to, like, people are putting money toward these artists, which is incredible, but like, what happens when we actually need to be fighting for reproductive rights? And so I don't know how you blend these two things. This is like a juxtaposition and tension that's existed for a lot of feminism. But maybe I'm just like a cynical New Yorker feminist lady who can't be happy about anything.
I thought it was funny. I know that Olivia Wilde got like a lot of heat for it, which I'm kind of just like, it's a joke. Like, it's not a joke, but I mean, it is a joke. It's absolutely a joke where like someone had like tweeted or X'd, I don't know what it's called anymore, that like, I hope, like, wouldn't it be great if Taylor Swift fell in love with a climate scientist or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
And it gave me a giggle. Like, we're allowed to giggle a little bit, guys.
Yes.
We are allowed to giggle.
Because
that
is
part of it. Yes.
And I think you have, I mean, like, really, you do have to have some levity. Like, things feel so heavy so often now. And if you don't laugh, you will cry. So might as well take the small wins.
I couldn't agree more. What, like, going back to your podcast, I'm very excited. I know, like, even just dipping into like the Oprah episode, which I remember very vividly as well. And like, I remember the diet culture of the 90s and the early aughts and everything, just like fat free, Jenny Craig, all the things. And you guys specifically go back and revisit Oprah's infamous episode, which was also her most watched episode of all time, with where she like pulls a wagon of like the amount of body weight that she lost in it was represented by a wagon full of fat, like actual animal fat. And it's just like even just revisiting some of the topics that of the episodes that have come out so far, it just goes, it like kind of snaps my brain and going like, oh yeah, that's crazy. That's insane. That is, I cannot believe that happened. And like how often like she was asked about her weight when she was like, she's such an accomplished woman. And so what other, like, have there been other things that maybe didn't make the cut because there's only so many episodes you can do right now? Like, or what other things have you looked back and revisited? I saw in like a teaser that you might be revisiting the Dawson's Creek episode where Pacey sleeps with his teacher.
Yes.
Very much remember that.
Okay. Yes. You remember Tamara, Miss Jacobs? Yeah, that's an upcoming one. I mean, it's like our list is so long and we really have to pick and choose because there's so many of these. And once you start going down the rabbit hole, there's more and more. But yeah, so I watched Dawson's Creek in high school. It was like everyone's favorite show. One of my best friends would host watch parties at her house. And at one point, the New York Times, where I now work, obviously came to report a story about these like kids in Seattle who were gathering to watch this salacious show, and like the feminist mom was allowing them to watch it. So it was hilarious to look back on that. But yeah, there was this hot and heavy relationship between Pacey and Miss Jacobs, his 38-year-old English teacher. Pacey, I'll remind you, was 15 years old, and he loses his virginity to her. And there's this like horrible cringe line where he's getting mad at one point and he's saying, "Well, I'm the best sex you'll never have." And you're just like, oh my God, Pacey, like you're 15. Like, first of all, that's not true under any circumstance. And second, like, this is just so disturbing on so many levels. However, I don't know how you feel about this or remember it, but I remember thinking this was like the hottest relationship
same.
Ever.
Oh, same.
And I was rooting for them.
I was rooting for them. I was like madly in love with him. I was just okay, like, yeah. This is a real love story. Like, everyone yes. needs to just like let them be together. And also, I'm like, he's a man, you know, like I'm watching it and I'm a little bit younger. I'm like, he's basically a grown up. Like,
well, also funny thing is that remember how the actors in that show were so much older than yes. the age they were playing? So he was a man. He was like in his 20s, as yes. was Dawson.
As was
so
I when like, I was playing was a teenager.
Weird,
yes.
Okay. Yeah. Weird yes. cognitive dissonance. Yeah. But absolutely. I totally remember that as well. We all thought Pacey was so hot. We all wanted this relationship to work. It like made him more hot that he was now experienced with this older woman. And nobody was really talking about it as a rape or an assault or whatever you would call that now if it were to happen today. And so we were revisiting this and then remembering that at the time this was playing out in my hometown in Seattle was also where the tabloid story of Mary Kay Letourneau was happening.
If that okay. was the same time.
Yes, I was going to yes. say, I don't know if you remember that case, but yes. she was a real teacher outside of Seattle who was impregnated by her 12-year-old student. And it was like, you know, tabloid gold. It was like, who is this woman? And yet, strangely, a lot of the headlines were about like this tryst and like, was it love? But not about the fact that, you know, this is a statutory rape well, according to the law.
Because also, it's if the roles were reversed and it had been a young woman with an older man, it's very like that's where it starts to, it's like it somehow pop culture would excuse it. It's like, oh, well, he wants it. He's a man. So like he's going to enjoy it. Like he's so lucky.
Yeah, he's so lucky.
He's so mm-hmm. lucky and so desired as this like young, where like that also became glorified in like with the MILF culture, you know, from American Pie. Like that just became like a pop culture thing in itself, which like, I can't believe. So I was wondering if that was around the same time. But then you reversed
yeah, the
it.
The exact same time.
Yes. And then I like one of the things I was thinking of, like, I was like, what was scarring to me as a teen? Like, what do I look back on being like, that was so inappropriate that I thought was like cool or like totally acceptable. And my version of that 100% was like a young woman's eligibility for legal sex when they turned 18. Because this was also a thing. Like, that's the thing. If it had been like a young girl and an older teacher, completely inappropriate pervert. But then the second that had she been 18, it's like, oh, well, she's eligible now.
Right.
She's it, like that. I feel like right. became the narrative. Like where remember everyone was obsessed when with the Olsen twins were going to turn 18.
Yes. Yes, yes. And weren't there even, there were like countdowns.
Yes, which is so creepy.
Yes.
That's so creepy.
So creepy. Yeah, somebody was mentioning this recently. That's another one we should look at. But yeah, there were so many of these. And even with some of the pop stars we've talked about, but like Britney Spears, I remember her first cover story in Rolling Stone. I think this was right after Baby One More Time came out. You would remember it. She's posing on the cover.
With the Teletubby.
The Teletubbies. Yes. Okay, yes. And so inside that spread, she's in her childhood bedroom, like posed with all of these little dolls. And it's just like this weird, infantilizing little girl, Lolita, but like sexy woman thing that I think still very much exists.
Yeah. And then within later, I was like looking up things around that time, like just like, what are things that maybe we look back at differently? And interestingly enough, Rolling Stone also put out an interview with Lindsay Lohan a week after she turned 18. And where was it? What did it say? It was so messed up. The actual cover said hot, ready, and legal. Exclamation point. Exclamation point.
Right. There's so many examples like that. And this, I mean, this was like the tabloid paparazzi era, you know, too. So like this was when, you know, like TMZ was getting its start and Perez Hilton and all of, like, remember the upskirt shot, which was just like paparazzi shooting up women's skirts. And that was deemed like a photo that you really wanted to get. And everyone was just okay with it. And it would be published on all these blogs. So it was like what was selling at that point in terms of the media culture was totally different as well. And it wasn't the age now where like, okay, if someone were to take a terrible paparazzi photo of Britney Spears now, it may still happen, but she'd then go on Instagram and say something about it. Yeah. Like she has a direct relationship with her audience.
But I just remember all of that stuff filtering into my brain thinking like it's taken me a while to kind of deprogram myself from that and be like, because I remember at that time being like, oh, I was living in LA, I was working in the industry. And I remember thinking if older men approached me and asked me how old I was, oh my God, they must like me. When it's like, no, 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 that is creepy. I know one of my favorite things to tell like any young like woman or a teenager, if they talk like as they're getting out into the world, I'm like, if any guy ever tells you that you act really mature for your age, run.
Not a compliment.
Run. That is not a compliment. Yeah. That is not a compliment at all.
It is, but that kind of thing, it's like, I can remember being told things like that and not really getting it. Yeah. Like it just, some of it is subtle, like it's not overt. And you realize, you know, years later that the way you thought about these things was actually really screwed up.
Very screwed up. What do you think, like, especially interviewing, you know, you had that year of kind of getting to know those three 13-year-old girls and what it's like to be 13 now. Like, are there things that you think about that they're going to look back on this time and be like, wow, I can't believe that that's what we were being fed from society? Or, and like, and then also counter to that, what do you think are some really positive things that hopefully they are taking in, you know, because there were a lot of wonderful, like, I do remember specifically, like, you know, being young and the Spice Girls and girl power and like watching female sports in a different way, you know, like there were a lot of like big, impactful, wonderful things that I look back on where it just, I felt like that were positive towards like my development as like a young woman and an adult woman now. But
yeah, well, side note, Spice Girls, that's another one we should do. I don't know if you're watching the Beckham documentary, but
I haven't watched it yet.
I didn't realize, I mean, I loved the Spice Girls, but I didn't realize that Posh, Victoria, was basically blamed for the loss of the World Cup, for Beckham losing the penalty shot and like, because they thought that he was distracted by his then girlfriend, soon to be wife. So anyway, another rabbit hole to go down. But yeah, in terms of the teen girls today, I mean, look, I think they're so much more educated about issues of feminism and equality and intersectionality and racial justice than I was at their age. So in a lot of ways, they're really advanced and smart. But I also think they suffer from too much information, you know, like the sheer amount of things being thrown at them at all time, whether it's like notifications on their phones or I didn't realize that if you're a teenager today and you go to school, the way that you're finding out about like quiz grades is through pop-up notifications on your cell phone. Like that to me is so stressful and I don't know how they're managing that. But also just the news, like the amount of information is just so overwhelming even for me as an adult. And so to think about a teenager who may not have the media literacy to be able to sift through and be like, oh, this is factual information. This is fake. Like, this is sending a bad message. This is not a real person. Can be concerning. And so that was part of what this piece was trying to get into was, you know, how do you, it's not as simple as just banning your kids from having phones, but like, how do you engage in having healthy conversations around it? And so I think for these girls, you know, some of the issues are the same. It's like puberty. It's finding out who you are. It's like, who are your friends? Who do you trust? Where do you fit into the social hierarchy? But you're doing it against this audience or this threat of an audience at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. Aren't we all? Aren't we all?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Luckily, we're grown women, yeah, so totally. Hopefully we have the psychology to manage it, though. Not always.
Oh, man. Well, Jessica, I could talk to you forever and ever. I'm going to let you go, but I have five last questions, a little conversation cool down before I say goodbye. It's kind of just the first thing that pops into your mind. You can keep it simple, one word, more than one word. But what is something that you like?
Seltzer. Drinking one right now. I don't know.
Are you like a flavored seltzer?
I'm a clear, no flavor seltzer.
Okay. All
right. Yeah.
Something that you know.
But I really care about the bubble frequency.
Oh, okay.
And strength.
Do you do it yourself with the thing?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I should.
I know. I should eventually. I'm like, one day I'll get one of those.
Yeah.
I don't know why, like, putting the flavor in it freaks me out. Like, I know it's flavored, but me seeing it goes like, oh, it's not natural. But this in a can that I don't see how it's put together, it just feels
weird. Yeah, I know.
Okay, something that you know.
Something that I know. I think I know myself, and I think it took me many years to be able to say that. But I really feel like I do trust my gut in a way that I didn't always.
Something that you hate.
I hate social media posturing.
That's a great answer. Something that you love that is not your partner, family, pets, but something that you love that brings you joy.
I love learning new things. And that's why I love being a journalist so much, because I get to delve into these weird subjects and like go really deep into them.
What's like even if you're not writing about it, what is like the latest little rabbit hole that you've gone down?
I'm currently going down a rabbit hole for the podcast about a Golden Girls joke in which they called lesbians Lebanese, and how that has become an enduring like wink in the gay community for when you don't want to say the word lesbian out loud, and so you call somebody Lebanese. Turns out there's like this long history of it.
I will also be going down that rabbit hole then. I can't wait for this episode. And then finally, Jessica, what is a quirky little fact about you?
Let's see. My husband would say I'm like really neurotic, and we have a lot of plants in our apartment, and I love having plants. But if he drips water on the floor when he waters them, I have like a meltdown. So I don't like water on the floor, apparently.
Do you have like a good try? Like, do you take care? You nurture your plants? You keep them alive?
He's in charge of the plants, and he's very good at it.
Okay,
very nurturing. Good. Except for the drips, you know what I'm saying?
I totally get what you're saying. Water and wood do not go well together.
They have white floors. It like stains.
Yeah, that's fair. That is fair. Well, thank you so, so much. I truly appreciate your time and am so excited for all your upcoming episodes. A Super Bloom podcast is hosted by me, Candace King, produced by Melissa DeMonts and Diamond Imprint Productions. Edited by Diane Kang. Post-production sound by Coco Lawrence. And advertising partnership with Acast.